Welcome everyone to Creating a Family, talk about infertility. Hey, do us a favor and let your friends know about this podcast. We would really appreciate it. People find out about podcasts through friends, so be a friend, let them know, and we'll say thank you. Today, we're going to be talking about the importance of egg and sperm quality in getting pregnant and what you can do about it. We'll be talking with Rebecca Fett. She has a degree in molecular biology and biochemistry and is the author of the best-selling fertility book, It Starts with the Egg. And I should add that the book has been recently, in fact, very recently, updated. And so even if you have heard about it in the past and are not sure have read it in the past, you should get the newest version because it's a lot of current research. That's what I did, and I must say I thoroughly enjoyed it. Welcome, Rebecca, to Creating a Family. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here speaking with you today.
As I just mentioned, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. The listeners to this show will tell you I love research and I liked, in fact, Creating a Family was more or less founded on the principle of trying to bring together the research community and the patient community. And this book does a phenomenal job of assessing what the research is, parsing out the good research versus that which really isn't that strong, and doing it in a way that is so easy to understand. And I truly can't recommend it enough. And let me thank you for doing this. It made my research geek heart go aflutter.
So. Well, that's lovely to hear. It's certainly sort of always been my objective to try to close that gap between what the research shows and what's happening out there in real life in practice, because I think there's so many, you know, wonderful discoveries being made that exactly. Never really reach the people who they can benefit. And I wanted to sort of help solve that problem and really make the research understandable for everyone and kind of translate it into practical steps that people can follow. And so it's great to hear that.
You did exactly that. And that's actually the mission of Creating a Family. So this is, you did exactly that. Well, let's start with your own story and why you decided to write a book about eggs, human eggs, that is.
Sure. So the story actually sort of goes back to when I was a teenager because I developed psoriatic arthritis when I was, 16, 17. But the upshot of that was that in my late 20s, when we wanted to start a family, I was told that pregnancy would be very, very dangerous for me. I had arthritis in my spine and hips. So I was told that, it would be high risk and, I may not be able to walk afterwards if I were to go through with a pregnancy. So surrogacy was really our only option. I contacted a surrogacy agency and they matched us with this really amazing surrogate who sort of now is kind of another member of our family, a truly extraordinary woman. And the next step in that process is to go through IVF to get the embryo to transfer to the surrogate. Mm-hmm. And I, at that point, I think I was 26 or 27. I had no reason to expect any fertility concerns. So we thought, now we get to the easy part. We just go through an IVF cycle and it should be pretty straightforward.
Yeah, you were the exception in that. I mean, you started very young.
Right.
Yes, you would had no reason to think that you would.
Exactly. So I thought everything should be fine. And I was in for a little bit of a rude awakening when we went to the IVF clinic, because it turned out I had diminished ovarian reserve / premature ovarian failure. There are various different terms for it. But basically, I was in the sort of fertility footprint of someone in their 40s. I had very low AMH and a very low follicle count on the ultrasound and was told I probably had less than a 5% chance of conceiving through IVF, which was a huge shock for me. It kind of came out of nowhere.
Oh, I can't really imagine. 26, 20, yeah.
Right. And so, but I put my kind of biochemistry and molecular biology training to work. That was when my first degree was in. And I really delved into all of the scientific studies on ovarian reserve and how age impacts fertility and egg quality. And I kind of came up with a plan of action for myself, and that covered dietary changes, supplements, and avoiding certain common toxins in plastics and fragrances, things like that. And I put my plan into action for a couple of months, and we went back to the IVF clinic for a repeat ultrasound and blood work. And the change was just extraordinary. I went from having 3 to 4 follicles maturing when they do the enteral follicle count by ultrasound. So I went from 3 to 4 follicles to about 20, which is sort of a perfectly normal number. And at that point, it could almost, it sort of looked like I no longer had diminished ovarian reserve. So we went ahead with the IVF cycle. We ended up getting 22 eggs retrieved, 19 of those fertilized. And even more extraordinary, of those 19 fertilized eggs, all 19 became high-quality blastocysts, 5-day embryos.
And that is not the usual.
No, that's really, I mean, it set a record for our clinic. They'd never seen anything like it, to have that many good quality embryos from one IVF cycle. And, you know, on the first transfer, we ended up conceiving my son, who is about to turn 6 tomorrow. which is kind of crazy to think that he, you know, just started out of that little bundle of cells. But so after I went through all of that and I realized that, you know, I was definitely onto something. This research has much wider implications. I really wanted to share what I had discovered in the studies with other people who were in the same shoes as me and who were really having problems with egg quantity and egg quality. And so I dove into the research even more to come up with a very comprehensive resource for everybody. And that became my book, It Starts with the Egg.
Okay.
Came out in 2014, and then I just updated it this year.
Yeah, because there has been a fair amount of research that's happened in the interim in those 5 years. And the title is It Starts with the Egg, but it could also have been titled It's All About the Egg, because really it emphasizes the importance of egg quality. So why is egg quality so important?
Well, it really just dictates the chance of success at basically every stage. So a good quality egg is much more likely to fertilize. It's much more likely to make it through the first critical few days of embryo development. And then a good quality egg is going to lead to a higher quality embryo. And so that embryo is more likely to implant. It's more likely to make it through the early stages of pregnancy, because as it turns out, the single most common cause of early miscarriage is actually problems with egg quality in the form of chromosomal abnormalities. Mm-hmm. When we talk about egg quality, you know, one of the main features is having an egg with the correct number of copies of chromosomes. And so when that goes wrong, an IVF cycle could fail at any point. Whereas if the more eggs you have with the correct number of chromosomes, the more likely you are to get a good number of good quality embryos that can implant and go on to lead to a successful pregnancy.
So we're born with all the eggs. Women are born with all the eggs we're ever going to have. So what can we do post-birth to improve our egg quality?
Well, I think the first really important point to kind of keep in mind is that most of the time, all those eggs are in a state of suspended animation. They're kind of sitting there on the shelf on hold, on pause. And then a couple of months before any given egg is ovulated, it has to go through this very delicate process of ejecting an extra copy of each chromosome. And that process requires a tremendous amount of energy. And so the more we can support the energy production in the egg during those couple of months, then the more likely an egg is to mature correctly with the correct chromosomes by the time it's either ovulated or collected by egg retrieval for IVF. And so that gives us the overarching goal of how do we support the energy production in a developing egg? And one of the, you know, that kind of, there's sort of three categories to that: diet, supplements, and then avoiding toxins. And I'm happy to sort of go into whichever one of those three you might like to explore first.
Let's start with avoiding toxins. Not necessarily because that's more important, but just because that's the way I've thought about it. So.
Right. Well, it may be one of the most important. This kind of discovery really took the world by storm when these researchers, they sort of discovered by accident. They were looking at these developing eggs, and I can't remember whether it was mice or rats, but they suddenly saw all these problems with the eggs. And it turns out they had changed the water bottles that the mice, let's just call them mice, I think they were mice, that the mice were drinking from. And it turns out those water bottles had BPA. And the BPA was compromising the egg development for the animals. And then that sort of spent all this research, and it turns out the exact same thing happens for humans. So BPA and other toxins from plastics really do compromise egg development. And if we can kind of make a few smart choices in our kitchens, you know, perhaps buying a stainless steel water bottle, minimizing canned foods, that kind of thing, then we create a much better, healthier environment for eggs to mature. And so BPA is one of the big aspects of that. And the other one is phthalates. And those are found in fragrances and more probably more concerningly these days in processed foods. Mm-hmm. And so if you can sort of minimize your intake of fast food and processed food and switch to sort of eating more fresh fruits and vegetables, things that are made from home, from natural ingredients, you can really bring down your phthalate levels a lot. And that is very helpful for fertility in a variety of ways, because phthalates are what's known as endocrine disruptors. So they can interfere with the action of all kinds of hormones. And that's harmful for both male and female fertility. And so that we really have this amazing opportunity to improve fertility just by making some kind of little simple switches in what we're eating and drinking and purchasing for our home.
So when talking about BPA, if you could just give three tips for reducing BPA exposure, what would they be?
I think first and foremost would be getting rid of old plastic food containers in your kitchen and switching to glass or stainless steel if you can. Then minimizing canned food. A lot of cans these days will say BPA free, but the companies are using alternatives that are very, very similar, such as BPS or BPF, and they may have exactly the same effects. And so it's really better to buy fresh, dried, or frozen things instead of foods that are packaged in cans.
And isn't it the lining of the can? And the hard part is that if you think, okay, I'm just going to buy cans that don't have a lining, good luck. I don't consume a lot of canned foods, but canned beans are one of the things, and in the winter, tomatoes. And both of those are, it's very difficult to find them without lining.
I think the funny thing is it's easier for companies to make safer lining for things like canned beans than tomatoes. So for canned beans, this company Eden Organics makes a brand that's quite safe. But they have said for tomatoes, they need to use different kind of lining because of the acidity. And so I actually think, you know, if your lifestyle is such that eating canned beans is a sort of a way to get good nutrition for you and you would otherwise eat, you know, something even more processed, then maybe choosing a BPA-free brand for that might be okay. But still for tomatoes, I really would avoid all canned tomatoes and buy, you know, perhaps a sauce packaged in glass if you can.
Well, you've just kind of messed up my cooking for the winter, but
well, you know what I love to do with beans is pressure cook a large batch and then freeze them. Yeah. I find that really convenient.
It's the tomatoes that's harder because not in the summer. If you go to the farmer's market, you can get good tomatoes, but in the winter, the stuff they sell is, you know, is in the store and the produce section has got the taste of cardboard. And right. So if you're going to any dishes, but, and I guess, and I have not heard of any safe canned tomatoes, but I hadn't thought about the fact that there might be some that are coming in jars. I'll look for those, you know, crushed tomatoes or diced tomatoes or something along those lines. Okay. So you're going to give us three tips. One, reduce plastics or do away with plastic food storage in your kitchen. The other one is switch to either fresh or frozen and avoid canned foods. What would be the third one? And this is for avoiding BPA.
Just to generally reduce highly processed foods, because when these food manufacturers are in the factory and they 300 different steps to prepare some highly processed food, many of those steps are going to involve plastics. And so researchers have found much higher levels in foods that are more highly processed. So, you know, if you want protein for your breakfast, you're better off with eggs rather than a protein powder, you know, because protein powders actually can have some BPA. So it's just a general shift towards whole natural foods when you can and eating at home rather than restaurants. You know, if you're going to a restaurant and end up with something that's a bit more processed, that they'll serve you a hot dish in a plastic box, that's not as good an option as preparing something at home or even perhaps just getting a salad or something like that.
So, and now three tips for avoiding phthalates. One would be the same one, I think. That would probably be reducing your highly processed foods.
Exactly. That's actually probably the most important. They did a study, I think it was in San Francisco, where they had some families switch to not having any processed foods for a few days. And the phthalate levels just dropped dramatically, even more than anybody thought they could that quickly. So just avoiding processed foods really makes a big difference for phthalates. The second step would be to minimize fragrance in personal care products. So, you know, stop wearing perfume and nail polish if you can and switch to fragrance-free items, because phthalates are used to make fragrances last longer in, you know, shampoos, lotions, perfumes, even fabric softeners. They're also used kind of for structural purposes in hairsprays and things like that. So avoiding fragrance and buying products that are labeled phthalate-free when it comes to personal care products is makes a big difference. So the general philosophy of trying to minimize fragrance applies to kind of anything in your home. But when I say that, I don't want people to get overwhelmed and think they have to rush out and start replacing everything. You can just kind of choose your battles, choose your priorities, probably prioritize things that are being put on your skin or that you use every day, and then sort of gradually replace your products as budget permits.
Okay, so the two primary environmental toxins that we need to worry about, which is not to say that they're the only ones, but the ones that are most supported by research, would it be fair to say would be phthalates and BPA?
Yes. And then there's sort of new research coming down the pipeline about these non-stick chemicals. I think you had Professor Tracy Woodruff on your show a little while ago speaking about that. And that's something that's also kind of becoming more clear that we should try to cook with safer materials such as stainless steel or cast iron rather than non-stick pots and pans if we can.
Okay, excellent. All right. Now, considering and also staying in the environment, if not necessarily toxin, let's talk about the role of vitamin D in conception, pregnancy, and miscarriage.
Sure. So this is an area where we're getting new studies all the time. And I just recently published my third book. This one is about what you can do during pregnancy to support your baby's brain development. And it turns out vitamin D is really important there too. So anyway, the role of vitamin D just gets bigger and bigger. But taking a step back, going to the fertility context, it looks like the level of vitamin D that we need for optimum fertility is a little higher than what doctors are considering the minimum or the normal level. So if you go to your doctor and get a vitamin D test and they tell you your level's fine, they are probably looking at that from the perspective of these threshold levels that were set for bone health. The level that seems to be optimal for fertility is a little bit higher. So it's you know, depending on who you ask, it's somewhere around 30 to 40 nanograms per mil seems to be preferred for fertility. And that's because vitamin D reduces inflammation. It helps to regulate the immune system. And it's also in and of itself a hormone, and it affects the activity of other hormones. So ensuring that you have adequate vitamin D levels is very important for fertility. And researchers have looked at IVF success rates for people who have vitamin D deficient levels of vitamin D, and they've found a better odds if you have enough vitamin D.
Vitamin D, you can also, it's the one that your body can manufacture on its own from exposure to sunlight. So I've always heard that if you've gotten 15 minutes of sunlight a day over a fair amount of your skin, your arms exposed, that generally speaking, that will give you an adequate amount of vitamin D, in fact, significantly more and probably better processed vitamin D than supplementation. Is that not true?
That's true in certain parts of the world at certain times of the year. But as one of the top vitamin D researchers has commented, that if you're in Boston in the middle of winter, standing naked in the city, you cannot make any vitamin D at all, because the sun is not at the right angle. It doesn't have strong enough rays basically to generate any vitamin D. And so you can generate vitamin D from the sun in summer in most places, but in winter, generally you will need to be getting, you know, vitamin D either from foods, and there's some in foods such as salmon and egg yolks, but most people will need a supplement to get up to the optimal level for fertility.
Is there a type of supplement? Is there does the generic brand that you get at the supermarket or the supermarket, grocery store, whatever you call it, is the generic brand equally as good, or do we need to be focusing on a specific type of vitamin D, or is all vitamin D created equal?
All vitamin D is not created equal, but that doesn't mean you need to sort of choose a very expensive brand. The main thing to look for is vitamin D3 rather than vitamin D2. Because that's the active form. And you want to buy it in the form of an oil-based soft gel rather than a solid tablet. And that's because it seems to be absorbed better. But you can buy a vitamin D3 soft gel supplement very inexpensively from a whole range of different brands, and they should all work quite well. I have had some people contact me in my Facebook group for the book saying that they were having trouble getting their levels raised and they switched to a liquid drops for vitamin D, and that's just purely, you know, based in olive oil. And several people have told me that those supplements seem to raise their levels better.
Hmm.
So that's something to consider, but, you know, and that's a bit more expensive, but it doesn't seem to be required. It's just sort of a backup plan if the other sort of more basic supplements are not working well.
Okay. And should people get tested, or should, because some doctors will automatically, you know, not object at all to running the vitamin D test, and others won't. And if they are, they wouldn't encourage it. And so you're going to have a hard time getting your insurance to pay for it.
Sure. So I think if you can't get your doctor to agree to test, one option is actually, in most states, you can order tests yourself very cheaply. I think you know, $20 through various different lab test providers. There's certain states where you're not allowed to do that, but in most states, you can order it yourself online, and then you take the order form into your local Quest or LabCorp, and they'll draw it for you.
Okay.
And that's, so you can usually get tested. It's helpful because even though most people could benefit from taking a vitamin D supplement, if you know your level, you can sort of get the best dose. And so you might turn out to be much more deficient than you thought and need a much higher dose supplement than is typically recommended. And it's very helpful to know that, because then you can bring your levels up more quickly.
We should mention that if you are actively trying to get pregnant, or anytime you start using, regardless of your conception plans, anytime you start using above the recommended dosage for any supplement, you should confirm this with your doctor first.
Of course. Yes, definitely.
Yes, to make certain that it is, in your case, recommended.
The one thing to note there, though, is that the Endocrine Society for the United States, which makes all the practice guidelines for this, their recommendation is to take quite a high dose if you are deficient. I think they recommend 10,000 IUs for a couple of weeks, and then dropping down to a maintenance dose. So it actually is common practice to recommend quite a high dose of vitamin D in the very short term for people with a notable deficiency.
But if you see your test results come back, work with your doctor. Don't treat yourself in that case.
Right.
Okay. Let me pause for a minute and remind everyone that this show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. They want you to know about an app, the Ferticom app, which was developed by two reproductive psychologists, Dr. Ali Domar and Dr. Liz Grill. And the app is designed to help you cope with the many challenging and emotional life situations that come up inevitably when you are trying to conceive, particularly if it's not happening the way you had hoped it to. They go through daily scenarios and interactions, and then they suggest some techniques, and most of the techniques actually have science to back them up as to being effective at helping you cope. You can get more information about the Ferticom app at its website, which is, handily, FerticomApp.com. Right. So let's talk about the role of the thyroid in getting pregnant, as well as in contributing to miscarriage. We'll jump to talking about the supplements and diet here in a minute. And this is not really environmental per se, but I think it's important to talk about some of this information first, because your thyroid functioning is an important element in conception.
Yes, it's very important. And it seems to be something that's often missed. Or, you know, the common scenario that I hear about is women who will get a thyroid test and the doctor will perhaps only order one lab value, the TSH, and it will come back a little high, but the doctor will say, oh, it's not worth treating, and they'll move on. And then the patient will go through many failed rounds of IVF cycles or repeated miscarriages. They'll go for further sort of thyroid testing and discover actually the problem, you know, is a bit more significant than thought. They'll treat it and suddenly all their luck will turn around and they'll have a much better time getting pregnant or maintaining a pregnancy. So the real problem with thyroid, with sort of the thyroid conditions and the link to fertility and miscarriage, is just the lack of diagnosis and lack of treatment. Because I think quite a few doctors are really not aware of how much impact it has. And the values that they consider normal are not optimal for fertility.
You talked about hyper, which means a high overfunctioning or a higher levels of thyroid. But what about hypo, which would seem like it would be the more troublesome, but perhaps I'm wrong.
Right. No, you're absolutely correct. When we talk about high TSH, that actually means low thyroid function. Yeah. So that's hypo. Yeah.
Okay,
so
gotcha.
I'm sorry to be confusing. I was actually talking about hypo. Yes, hyperthyroidism does also cause some fertility problems, but it's very rare, whereas hypothyroidism is actually becoming quite common. It's an autoimmune condition, and the prevalence is increasing, and there seem to be a lot of cases of very borderline hypothyroidism that really does have an impact on miscarriage rates. And I would really encourage anyone whose values come back a little on the borderline, or if their values come back normal, but they actually feel like they have symptoms of hypothyroidism, such as, you know, cold intolerance, very dry skin, you know, very slow digestion, fatigue, muscle pain, thinning hair. If you feel like you may have hypothyroidism or your lab values are a little off, but your doctor's not taking it seriously, go and see a specialist endocrinologist and talk to them and discuss with them the fact that the optimal TSH for fertility is probably around one, or one to two, you know, some doctors say two, but even down getting it down to one seems to be the preferred. And so if you can work with a doctor who's willing to treat you properly for that, it could really make a huge difference.
Okay, excellent. And the next one I want to bring up has a fair amount of research to support it, but I think will be a surprise to a lot of people, and that is oral hygiene, brushing your teeth.
Right.
I think that when I have mentioned this to people, it takes them totally by surprise that, I mean, what in the world would oral hygiene have to do with getting pregnant? So let's talk about it. What in the world does
it? Right. It is a big surprise. And the link actually comes down to inflammation.
Yeah.
So if you have problems with gum health, that can actually cause inflammation throughout the body. And then inflammation compromises fertility. And so that's why, you know, I like to recommend getting a dental checkup. And if you have signs of periodontal disease or gum disease, working with your dentist to sort of address that, just in case it helps. You never know what could be going on. You know, what you don't need another problem layering on to whatever else could be going on with your fertility. Even if it's not the main issue, you just kind of want to cover all your bases, address everything that could be going on to give yourself the best chance.
Exactly. Let me tell you that this show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, would not and could not happen without the generous support of our partners. And our partners are clinics and organizations that believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate, research-supported information to the patient as well as the nurse community. I want to tell you about two of our partners, and one is Walgreens and Alliance RX, which is Walgreens Prime. They provide specialized fertility pharmacy services through an experienced care team that is available 24/7, and they are devoted to helping patients achieve successful outcomes. They understand the importance of timing and the need, timing for getting your medications, that is, and the need for personalized treatment, and they're committed to compassionate care and support throughout your journey to have a family. Another one of our wonderful partners is Cryos International Sperm and Egg Bank. They are dedicated to providing a wide selection of high-quality, extensively screened, frozen donor sperm and eggs from all races, ethnicities, and phenotypes. And they also prepare their sperm for both home insemination as well as for fertility treatment. They are the world's largest sperm bank and the first freestanding independent egg bank in the United States. All right, so we've talked about now environmental factors, and then we've talked about some other just general, I guess we'll call those weird factors.
And then, you know, there's one other weird factor we didn't cover that I just want to flag just in case it's relevant to somebody, and that's celiac disease.
Yeah, okay.
So the research is not clear how much impact celiac disease can have on fertility, but every now and then it is the problem. And so if you have any reason to be suspicious, and you know, celiac disease runs in families. So if you have a family member who has celiac disease, or you have symptoms from ingesting gluten, and it's not just your typical digestive symptoms, that can be rashes, joint pains, anemia. If you have any reason whatsoever to think celiac could be going on, get a test for it. And your doctor will often run tests for the antibodies in your blood. If you're already on a sort of somewhat gluten-free diet because you've always sort of suspected you have a problem with gluten, a better way to test is with just a simple cheek swab DNA test, and that can tell you whether you carry the gene for it. And so my personal belief is if you carry the gene for celiac disease and you feel like you may have symptoms, then a gluten-free diet can be really helpful for fertility. And that's because it will help you avoid nutrient deficiencies and will reduce inflammation.
And then we should mention that celiac is not the same thing as gluten intolerance or people who are choosing to be gluten-free for other reasons. It's actually a diagnosable disease, is it not?
Right. It's an autoimmune disease. It's a genetic autoimmune disease where if you ingest gluten, your body starts damaging its own tissues and it will damage your gut lining so you can't absorb nutrients. That seems to be why it has such an impact on fertility, because you can't absorb folate or vitamin B6 or vitamin B12 or all of these other critical nutrients that you need for your fertility.
Including a lot of inflammation. I mean,
yes, exactly. And it triggers inflammation. And both of those problems can also lead into miscarriage. So if you have recurrent miscarriage, screening for celiac disease is something to seriously consider. And a lot of the sort of immunology focused specialists in recurrent pregnancy loss now do routine testing for celiac disease, which is a wonderful development. Yeah. Because for some people, it really turns everything around. And I met a woman who had several pregnancy losses and two stillbirths, and it turns out it was because of celiac disease. And once she was diagnosed and once she went on a very strict gluten-free diet, she finally had a healthy baby. And you just can't imagine, what if someone had told her that 5 years earlier, how different her life could have been, how much suffering could have been avoided. So that's why I always like to mention that one to people who've gone through a really rough road. Just get the test. It could be a life changer.
And to say nothing, I mean, celiac is a very serious disease on its own. And regardless of your conception plans,
right?
Yeah, you want to be diagnosed with that.
Yes.
Okay. Now let's talk about diet. We'll do diet before supplements. So what type of diet is the science showing is best for, and I want to talk about both natural conception, so just kind of increasing your fertility generally, as well as those for the conception through IVF, so people going through an IVF cycle.
It seems to be that the most effective diet is a Mediterranean one. And, you know, that means a lot of different things to different people. But from the studies, what really seems to help fertility the most is more fish, more sort of olive oil, nuts, and vegetables, and less of highly processed foods, less sugars and refined grains, and more sort of legumes and things like that. And there's two or three different aspects to all of that. The first is what type of fats are involved. And you want more of the anti-inflammatory fats like omega-3 fats and monounsaturated fats from, you know, avocados, olive oil, nuts, and less of the fats that cause inflammation, which is saturated fats and omega-6s. And so by shifting a little more towards sort of fish and away from, let's say, bacon, you can get a healthier balance of fats, and that seems to reduce inflammation. The second aspect of it is just getting more nutrients. You need a lot of vitamins to produce healthy eggs and sperm and to support a healthy pregnancy. And so if you're eating very nutrient-dense foods, such as sort of chicken and fish and vegetables and legumes, then you're getting a lot more of the nutrients that you need. Especially vitamin B6, B12, and folate. Those are the big ones. And then the other side of it is managing blood sugar. And this seems to actually be the most important for a lot of people. Blood sugar has a huge impact on fertility, because if you have these, you know, massive swings of high blood sugar, whether, you know, from eating, you know, sugary beverages or a lot of very refined carbohydrates, that actually alters your hormone levels. So high blood sugar leads to high insulin, and that interferes with the testosterone balance. And when you interfere with testosterone balance, you interfere with egg development, and it all just starts to go wrong. The more, you know, very sugary or very refined carbohydrates you eat, the worse your fertility will be, the worse your egg quality will be. And that requires a bit of a dietary shift for some people. Sometimes people can get a little carried away and they start to fear, oh, I really want a piece of toast, but I'm so worried it's going to damage my egg quality. I don't want people to worry about that. I just hope that people will kind of start to reduce the very refined carbohydrates and start to shift more towards sort of slower burning carbohydrates. So legumes are a great choice there, or sort of whole grains rather than you know, very refined white grains and things like that, and cutting back on sugar. And it does make a massive difference. And the people who seem to improve the most from altering their carbohydrate intake are those with PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and their blood sugar and insulin really seem to be part of the process of causing infertility. Those people, when they go through an IVF cycle, they'll have many, many eggs retrieved, but they will typically be immature and won't fertilize. Whereas once people start to cut back on carbohydrates, the insulin balance corrects itself a little more, and they might end up with fewer eggs, but they're better quality, more likely to fertilize, more likely to make it through every stage.
A number of years ago, I read some interesting research that talked about the percentage of your diet that should be protein-based. And this was not a large study, and I haven't followed through to see if there's been recent research on this. So what is the research indicating as far as is high protein? Now, you could argue that if you're cutting back on your carbohydrates, it would automatically be, you know, your percentage of protein would be going higher, but it doesn't necessarily work that way. So how much protein should you be aiming for, just roughly speaking, as far as your diet, just rough percentages?
Well, I think the study you might be thinking of was one that's discussed in the book towards the end of the book there. And a doctor had these patients reduce the carbohydrate intake a little, not dramatically, and then increase the protein intake from, I think, 20% up to 30% of total calories.
Yeah,
and that change alone was made a massive difference for them. And so you don't need to sort of suddenly adopt the diet of a bodybuilder and eat huge amounts of protein at every meal, but just going up to sort of getting a third of your calories from protein is enough and seems to be very, very helpful. And that could mean rather than just having cereal for breakfast, perhaps you have yogurt with a little cereal or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then trying to get, most people do fine at getting protein at dinner, but just trying to get a little protein with breakfast and lunch. And that will not only provide additional nutrients, but also then help to manage your blood sugar too.
You know, I think for some women, and I'm speaking for myself, always making protein is not where I tend to focus and so or crave. So that's something that it's a challenge for me and I have to think about to do. And I think I'm not alone in that as far as having to focus on making certain that every meal has a protein source in it.
Yeah, but it does seem to be quite helpful once you can get into the habit, it does sort of become a bit more automatic.
Okay, excellent. Now let's move over to talking about supplements. And a large portion of your book is dedicated to the discussion of supplements. And the book, by the way, is It Starts with an Egg. So what supplements should women who want to get pregnant be using? And let me go back to saying that if you are actively trying to get pregnant, or even if you're not, anything that we're saying, you should be consulting with your reproductive endocrinologist if you're seeing one, if not with your general practitioner or your primary care physician. Because overdoing it on supplements, you know, they can become like medicine if you do too many or too much.
Right.
All right, so let's talk about what supplements do you generally recommend for women who are trying to conceive?
So it's a little bit different depending on this particular scenario. So a woman with diminished ovarian reserve might need different supplements than a woman with PCOS versus someone with recurrent miscarriage. So in the book, the supplement advice is sort of tailored to different scenarios.
I liked that, guess, by the way. It was, yeah, it's, you know, the average and then medium, you know, they've got some reasons for concern and then you've got advanced. And that was really, I thought, very helpful.
Right, because some women will need a lot more help than others. The one supplement that seems to be most generally applicable, most useful across the board, is CoQ10. And the reason that is so helpful is that CoQ10 is actually a natural part of these tiny little power plants that's in every cell of the body called the mitochondria. And those and the mitochondria make the energy for eggs to develop correctly. And we all have CoQ10 in our cells helping this energy process, but it declines with age. And so if we can, you know, researchers have found that if we can top up the levels a little bit, the quality of egg, during those 3 to 4 months when an egg is maturing, the quality of the egg can improve quite dramatically. And that's been reflected in clinical studies of CoQ10 showing higher fertilization rates, higher implantation rates of embryos and even higher pregnancy rates. And, you know, when the book first came out in 2014, this was very cutting edge, brand new. No one was really doing it. No one was really talking about it. But I sort of gave it a shot. It worked for me. And I talked about it in the book in the first edition. Since that time, we've had so many new studies confirming that it really is truly helpful. And so it's kind of a core part of the supplement regime for the book.
Yeah.
And I've heard from so many people who that was, you know, kind of the only supplement they added. They focused on the toxins and the diet. And then otherwise, the only supplement they added was CoQ10. And they just had a real turnaround in the quality of their eggs from one IVF cycle to the next.
And is CoQ10 available in the pharmacy or health food store? It's readily available.
Yes, it is. It's very easy to find because it's actually widely recommended for many other conditions, for sort of for heart conditions, for, you know, anyone taking statins is told to take CoQ10. So it's a widely used supplement, very widely studied. There's two main forms. The cheapest one, the easiest to find, is called ubiquinone. It's not absorbed very well. So if you have the budget, it's better to choose a form called ubiquinol. And that is absorbed much better. And there are a couple of different brands that make that. They all get it from the same manufacturer in Japan. So, you know, it doesn't matter particularly which brand you buy for ubiquinol, but it is helpful to get that form because it's absorbed better. And the studies show that it does work better too.
Okay, so excellent. So we've got CoQ10 is an important one and probably the first one you should be thinking about. All right, so what other supplements should we be considering? And go in order of applicability to most people and then kind of work up into those who have had multiple miscarriages or who have been struggling for longer periods with infertility.
Sure. So the next category that's sort of quite generally applicable is antioxidants. And antioxidants are important because they kind of help to mop up all this free radical damage that can happen to developing eggs. And so antioxidants include vitamin E, vitamin C, alpha-lipoic acid, and acetylcysteine, melatonin. The book talks about kind of which one of those might be right for which circumstance, but sort of the general philosophy of choosing a couple of antioxidant supplements is generally helpful across the board. The next major supplement would be myo-inositol, which is really for people with PCOS. So if you have PCOS, you know, that's something to explore. It seems to be very effective.
Well, let me stop on that. What is myo-inositol?
So it's almost related to the B vitamin family. It's a naturally occurring compound. It's involved in how insulin signaling works. And so insulin is part of the problem in PCOS, and myo-inositol helps to kind of fix that problem. And there are a lot of good studies showing that it works very well.
Okay, excellent. And let's stop now and say, for any of the supplements you've mentioned up to this point, are there negative side effects that you need to be aware of?
Yes. I mean, I can't really summarize all of this. This is a huge part of the book. I can't really list everything. You have to choose the right supplement for the right scenario. A couple of things to keep in mind. So melatonin is better if you're trying to conceive through IVF than if you're trying to conceive naturally, because it could disrupt ovulation. So if you're trying to conceive through IVF, that doesn't really matter. Your ovulation's not ovulation, but the whole process is very carefully orchestrated by medications.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas if you're trying to conceive naturally, disrupting ovulation is a problem. So melatonin supplements may not be the best choice. That's not to say if you're taking melatonin for sleep, it's going to stop you conceiving naturally. That doesn't seem to happen. I just wouldn't want someone to rush out and start taking it unless they're going through IVF. And then, you know, there's various other little issues, like alpha-lipoic acid may be contraindicated for people with hypothyroidism. Some of the supplements cause a little mild tummy upset, things like that. But just the general philosophy is always check with your doctor before you add in a supplement, as you suggested, just in case.
Okay.
And then the other sort of the final supplement that's sort of a bit more specific would be DHEA. And that stands for dehydroepiandrosterone. And this is a precursor to many of the hormones in our body. Women and men both naturally make DHEA as a stepping stone along the way to making testosterone and estrogen and other hormones. With age and with certain medical conditions, there can be a decline in DHEA, and that can really compromise egg development. And that seems to be the biggest problem in premature ovarian failure. Like, you know, for me, for instance, I suspect DHEA was the most important supplement that I took, because there's a big link between autoimmunity and premature ovarian aging, because the autoimmunity seems to damage the adrenal glands, and the adrenal glands produce DHEA. So I have a lot of autoimmune conditions, lucky me, psoriatic arthritis being one of them. And that's probably why I had infertility at such a young age, because I was not producing enough DHEA. By taking that supplement, I think everything turned around. And that, so that is something that can be, it also can be helpful for age-related infertility, because with age, DHEA levels drop as well. But DHEA is a hormone. It is not, you know, a nutritional vitamin supplement anybody can add on. I strongly encourage people to get their levels tested before they supplement with it. And so I have information in the book and on my website about that, about which test to ask for, what levels to look for. And then also it's important to monitor your levels after you start the supplement, because you want to be taking the right dose. And hopefully your doctor can sort of guide you in that. But many are not really familiar with the studies in the area. So it's a little bit of a struggle for some people figuring out how much to take, how often to test, and whether their levels justify adding a supplement or not. So DHEA can be a tricky one, but it can be a very, very helpful one. For many women, the single most helpful thing they can do.
In particular, if they are primary premature ovarian insufficiency.
Yeah, or age-related infertility. And actually, it's an interesting story of how DHEA really kind of came into the limelight for fertility supplements. It turns out there was this one IVF patient in New York who was, like, a few years before I came along, was digging through the research, and she found one little study that gave her a sort of suspicion that it could help. So without telling her doctor, she just started taking it. And she did a lot of IVF cycles, and every cycle, she was in her early 40s. With every cycle, she got more eggs and better eggs and more eggs and better eggs. And then her IVF clinic was just astounded, and they picked up the research on this and started testing it on more patients and found that it really does work. And now that clinic has done many different clinical studies, and they've given us clear evidence that DHEA supplements for the right women can improve IVF success rates quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And it was all from this one very dedicated IVF patient.
Yeah. And at least last year, I believe, at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine conference, there was a fair number of posters that, if I'm remembering correctly, that it's now being studied pretty widely.
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, though, I hear every single day from women who go to their doctor and say, I have heard DHEA can be helpful for age-related infertility. Can you please test my levels? I'd like to take the supplement. And the doctor will either say, sure, take the supplement. We don't need to test your levels first, which I don't recommend. Or the doctor will say, there's no evidence. Don't take it. And both are just wrong. The no evidence one really bothers me, because they're really, I think there's about a dozen studies now, and the evidence is quite clear. And so I'm looking forward to the day when more reproductive endocrinologists are really familiar with the research on it and understand how beneficial it can be and how to sort of prescribe it best.
Yeah, exactly. And this is not necessarily your area of specialty, but I thought you might have some information on it. And that is the efficacy of Chinese medicine and acupuncture on fertility. What's the current research showing, or do you know? It's fair to say you don't. That's not the...
Well, so I looked, when I was updating the second edition, I looked into the evidence on acupuncture a little, and there's a little bit of support for it. You know, just doing one acupuncture session the day before a transfer retrieval doesn't seem to have much benefit, but going regularly might be helpful. I'm not sure it's helpful enough that I would very widely recommend it, especially for people who don't enjoy it and don't find it relaxing. If you do find it relaxing, that in and of itself might be worth doing just for that reason. Mm-hmm. For Chinese medicine, Chinese herbs, I haven't done a lot of research on it, but what I have done is a little bit concerning to me, just because some of the preparations are contaminated with heavy metals and other chemicals that you would not want to be taking. So I kind of always prefer to err on the side of fewer supplements and only using proven supplements from very reputable manufacturers. And in China, a lot of Chinese medicine and Chinese herbs just doesn't fit that criteria for me. I know there are many practitioners who do recommend and do see positive results, but for me, the evidence is not there and the risks kind of are too high to justify.
Okay. And one thing I did want to ask before, we've already left diet, but I wanted to come back and talk to you about alcohol and caffeine use. not so much in when you're pregnant, but when you're trying to get pregnant. Because we know that at least with alcohol, that you should not be drinking during pregnancy. But if you're trying to conceive, what is the impact that the research is showing on the effect of alcohol on fertility?
So they both seem to be a bad idea. I mean, it's not an absolute bar. The occasional drink may be okay. It's funnily enough, caffeine may be worse than alcohol when you're trying to, when you know you're not pregnant, it's coming up to an IVF cycle. The occasional drink may not make that much of an impact, but caffeine does seem to be a little worse. And even small amounts of caffeine during early pregnancy, I would be quite concerned about, because it does seem to increase the risk of miscarriage. For both of those, just sort of try to do what you can to avoid them to the extent you can.
Okay.
For coffee, I also like to, for people who switch to decaf coffee, I like to recommend Swiss water decaf, rather than chemical, because there's different ways they can decaffeinate coffee. And if you can buy a brand that's Swiss water processed, it avoids a whole class of chemicals that can be present in decaf coffee.
Okay. And in the time we have left, I want to talk about sperm quality. We've spent a lot of time talking about the quality of eggs, but as we all know, to quote the often used, probably misused expression, it takes two to tango. So we know that we need both good quality egg, but we also need good quality sperm. So of the what does the evidence show? And maybe just talking about supplementation, and I'm assuming diet would be pretty much the same. But let's go through the high points of what you're talking about: environmental toxins, environmental exposures, diet, and supplements. What do we know that might be different for sperm quality?
So for environmental exposures, phthalates seem to have an even bigger impact for men than for women. So you really do need your husband to stop using all that heavily fragranced products he might have, and to try to cut back on processed foods. Diet, pretty similar effects. Red meat and sugar seem to be the worst things for male fertility. But I have a whole chapter in the book on all of the diet supplements, everything for male fertility. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know what to hit on, but so listeners can go to my website. It starts with theegg.com/male supplements, and there they'll find a summary of some of the supplements that can be helpful for men. And CoQ10 is a big one, a good quality multivitamin, and then a couple others, fish oil, carnitine. So,
okay. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca Fett, author of It Starts With the Egg, for talking with us today. It was very helpful. I highly recommend the book. It's a good read, and it's an interesting read. Let me remind everyone that the views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Also, keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, work with your infertility professional. Thanks for joining us today, and I will see you next week.